Esoterica Special Edition. Indie music. Unsigned music. Experimental music. Brought to you from the Esoterica program on WQNA-TV, the digital broadcast of the Springfield Community Broadcasters. SCBRadio.org.
Sit down with Mark Schwartz, who's had a number of experimental projects in and around Springfield, Illinois, and other places that he'll tell us about. He's back in the day with Untoward Quartet, and up to today with the End Times Trio, but also his many solo experimental projects and some new ones, including Forest Saints for a couple of years now, and Demons on Wheels. We speak specifically about intergalactic radio by Forest Saints and the problems that he encountered trying to solve those problems of experimentation, and then other ideas for the future.
So, did you have a chance to look over the questions?
I did.
The experimental questions?
I certainly did, yes. Sure did.
What'd you think of that?
Oh, very interesting. Very thought-provoking questions.
Yes. Tried to design them to be such.
Yes, definitely.
To be thought-provoking.
Yes.
So, what'd you come up with the first question? When did you first become aware of experimental sound and music?
Well.
To the best of your recollection.
Sure.
You're not on trial or...
Sure. Well, I would say that toward probably late 80s, I would say, is definitely started making a break away from mainstream popular music into more kind of subgenres and not typical music.
When was that, you said?
The late 80s, I would say.
Ah, yes.
And I was also kind of introduced to and discovered Yes. Of course, the old prog rock band. And they were one of the first ones that really started stretching my mind as far as different song structures, in particular long-form compositions. So it certainly wasn't your typical 3-minute-long song. Although, of course, their most popular song was Owner of a Lonely Heart, which pretty much fit into the popular genre. But, definitely their kind of deeper tracks, and, of course, going back through their catalog, of course, they had... like Tales from Topographic Oceans, which was a double album, but it was just 4 songs. So, I mean, it was one entire song per side on record. And, making 20-minute pieces of music was something totally different from what I, had been accustomed to and was aware of.
Right.
And then I went to music school for my freshman year of college. Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, and had the good fortune of having his name is Dr. E. Michael Harrington, and I had him for two classes. I had him for a music theory class as well as an ethnomusicology class. And the different musical approaches that he introduced in both of those classes, I would say, was nothing short of life-changing for me. Music theory, in particular, of course, was, you know, introducing a lot of course, your standard Western, you know, music composition information, but then also a lot of the experimental music, which he was very much into. He was actually the head of the experimental music ensemble at the school, and just introduced all sorts of different forms of composition, you know, time signatures, you know, serialism, minimalism, just all sorts of different things, graphic scores and things like that, as well as, you know, just atonality and things like that. So we also kind of started breaking some of the barriers as far as kind of that distinction between noise and sound, or music and noise, I guess you could say. You know, we'd be sitting in class and a car would honk its horn outside, and, you know, so, you know, immediately the question would be, well, what chord was that that was being played? You know, so, you know, you started approaching, you know, just sounds in life as being musical, and kind of that distinction between the two getting smaller and smaller. Of course, with the ethnomusicology, of course, introduced, you know, exposing the music from all over the world, you know, which was amazing and fantastic. And again, just finding out how much there was outside of just typical, you know, Western music and Western scales and Western type signatures and instrumentation and all of that, and just lots of deep discussion about, you know, what actually constituted music and sound, and just really kind of emphasized the idea that music is not a universal language. It's a method that's used universally, but people can't understand necessarily, you know, the language that's being spoken elsewhere. You know, there'd be music that, you know, might be played, you know, at an Egyptian funeral, for instance, that people would think was, you know, they wouldn't even think of it as being funeral music, for instance. So it's not necessarily the same message that's conveyed. And yeah, of course, along with that too, he also introduced, you know, just other artists who had incorporated other styles of music into their music, other, you know, ethnic styles and things like that. And also, you know, experimental musicians. So from him is where I learned about the whole downtown avant-garde New York music scene, consisting of people like, you know, Fred Frist and John Zorn and Tom Cora and everybody who's associated with that, and as well as kind of the outer jazz, free jazz. It's where I learned about Ornette Coleman and, you know, Don Cherry and things like that. So it was a very mind-opening experience, to say the least.
I bet. Sounds like, yeah. Well, obviously it would be.
Yeah, and I've thanked him numerous times since then. I've been able to stay in contact with him. And, you know, I mean, it's, like I said, it's really set me on a totally different musical path than I had been on.
Now, what was his name again?
Dr. E. Michael Harrington.
Ah.
He's very much into a lot of what he does now is copyright law, music copyright law. So he's been kind of expert witness in a lot of the major kind of major cases. That have been, you know, in the news about, you know, lawsuits about plagiarism and things like that, sampling and stuff like that goes on.
Huh.
But yeah, he is a brilliant, brilliant person. His joke always was that, I guess he was roommates with Alan Menken in college, Of course, Alan Menken being a composer of like Beauty and the Beast, it's a Little Mermaid and all the, you know, famous Disney tunes. And he always says, like, perhaps I should have followed the path of writing music for kids' movies rather than compositions that you play with your posterior. But yeah, he's a very, very entertaining and really intelligent character.
Did you ever, kind of a side note about playing with your posterior? Did you ever see Sun Ra on Saturday Night Live? And Buck Henry introduced him?
Oh, no, I haven't.
It came on one time on syndication. I saw it, and I actually grabbed my recorder, my VHS at the time, and got a shot of it on the TV. It was crazy. I mean, that's what Sun Ra was doing. He was basically playing with his butt on the keyboard.
Yeah, right.
Just bouncing around on the keyboard. When they got done, they cut over to Buck Henry to go to a commercial, and he was just like, he was speechless, didn't know what to do. He was confused and had this confused look on his face, and then he got himself together and said, we'll be right back.
Right.
People were scared. They got scared, something's wrong, oh my God, what's happening?
Right, what's going on, right.
Yeah.
Well, I can't remember I don't know if it's Ed Sullivan. I have a hard time thinking that that's what it was, but I mean, I remember watching a clip of Frank Zappa being on an old kind of variety talk show. I mean, it's black and white, film, so it was definitely a long time ago. And he played a song on a bicycle. I mean, using the bicycle as the instrument. And I just remember the host's just reaction was just pretty much dumbfounded.
I saw that. I remember seeing that.
They were doing really, just super cool things. And like, it was so much new stuff. I really can't say that I was able to soak all of it in. I mean, I was just, there was so much new stuff that I was introduced to when I went to music school. Just on pretty much every front musically, and just kind of repeatedly having my mind blown, for them to talk about doing a piece of music with the New Music Ensemble there at the school. Like they had a fish tank up on the stage, and they had a staff painted around it. And each person was assigned a fish. Each of the musicians on the stage was assigned a fish, and wherever that fish swam is what they played. It's things like that, but in Western music, you always think of everything as being fixed and, all this stuff, and it's just, again, just pretty much every concept that I had of music was just completely put to the test and called into question, and,
Wow.
I mean, it's kind of that idea of, you learn the rules so that then you can go on to like break them all.
Exactly. That's what we always said in art school.
Right. Definitely.
Or I should say art class. It wasn't an art school, but
right.
Art.
So yeah, I mean, I ended up quitting music school after the first year because, I was fortunate enough to have, Dr. Harrington is one of my professors. And then my private guitar teacher was also very, very supportive of just my own musical pursuits. But I would have to say that the program as a whole was, Nashville, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Nashville is really almost like the L.A. of the South, it is very commercially based, it's very studio musician based, and their whole goal kind of was to just turn out studio musicians who could go in. I think they were trying to be helpful in the sense that they wanted people to be able to survive by being a musician, and to do that, of course, their focus was on being versatile and being able to go in to a recording session as a studio musician and be able to play whatever was asked of you in whatever style was asked of you, with as little of your personality showing through, you know, as possible, but there, you know, supporting whatever artist was there, which was really kind of anti me. You know, that's not how I am. So it didn't sit well with me, you know, to go and be told on one hand not to write any music or perform any of my own music or work on anything on my own, you know, from a department head, you know, and then to go to a, you know, private guitar teacher and be like, you know, hey, keep on writing and bring whatever compositions you have here. You know, we'll, you know, don't let them ruin you type of thing. So,
wow.
So yeah, it was an uncomfortable fix. And I would have to say that actually once, again, there was so much to digest, that I would say that once I left music school is actually when I probably really was able to start digesting it.
Interesting.
So, and that probably kind of leads into the next question.
I was just going to say that. Doesn't that lead us there?
Yeah.
So that means you that at that point, which was when?
Would have had to have roughly been probably 1991.
So from the 80s to the 90s, you internalized it and started doing your own experiments.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably more so from like 89 to 91, probably.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you're
in the 80s, and then you're starting to do your output in the 90s.
Yeah, and I was so burnt out. I mean, you know, everybody and their dog in Nashville was a musician. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, you'd go walk down Music Row and it'd just be one band after the other, you know, come, you know, that you'd hear coming out of the bars or whatever, you know, just you'd walk down the street and, you know, passing people with their drumsticks sticking out of their back pockets and stuff. It was just, you know, it was so much of just the identity there that it just got tiresome to me. And plus, like I said, I had been introduced to so much other stuff that didn't fit into that. There was a period of time after that I put down music for a while. Especially when I was confronted with like the music of Fred Frith and the experimental music scene, you know, I was actually just having this conversation with my son the other night, which was, you know, typically, you know, as a guitarist, when I would listen to somebody play something, you know, I could picture what they were doing, you know, in, you know, even in music school, you know, we would have these, you know, listening exercises where you'd listen to a certain recording and then they would ask you about the room that it was recorded in, you know? And so you'd be like, oh, you know, I think it was about this size. This is what the material was. It was on the carpet. You know, there's a tiled section over here. You know, ceiling was probably this. You know, I mean, just by listening to the reverb qualities of the music. So, I mean, you're really listening to this, you know, specific things. And same thing with, you know, people used to make the joke of, you know, hey, what color is the guitar, you know, that the guy's playing? You know, hear that by listening to it. But, you know, typically, again, you know, you could picture what somebody was playing. But again, when I was, you know, finally, you know, when I finally took that leap, because, again, it was so confrontational, you know, at the time, just musically, just really challenged so many of my concepts about music, that it was like, okay, that's out there, and it's interesting to think about, but I don't know if I could absorb that. And so it wasn't until I actually took the dive and was like, okay, I'm going to explore this myself. And I mean, I used my notes and resources from my classes that I had, like pretty much as like lists of like listening lists, like go explore these people and go do these things. I mean, so I really started diving into experimental music and ethnic music and things like that, and listening to it on my own and trying to absorb it. And, you know, listening to Fred Frith, I could not picture what in the world he was doing when he was playing. Which, you know, to me was just mind-blowing, because it's like, I literally couldn't even conceive of how he could be conjuring the sounds of his instrument that he was. And, you know, and these were old recordings. I mean, so it's the stuff that was, it was, you know, I mean, this is stuff that had already been done and had been being done for, you know, a couple decades or whatever. So I suddenly felt like my musical vocabulary was really small compared to everything that was out there. And, you know, it's kind of like being, you know, an English speaker and finding out that you only know, like, a fifth of the language, you know? Or, you know, you're a painter and you discover that there are all these other colors that you had no idea existed. That's kind of how I felt musically. It's like there are these whole other languages, you know, palettes of sounds that I could add to my really what suddenly seemed very limited, you know, maybe musical vocabulary. So, you know, I quit. I quit playing for a long time, you know, a year or so, and just listened and just absorbed. And you know, once I started feeling like I kind of was beginning to understand some of it, then I started the whole exploration process, which is, okay, like, let me see what sounds I can conjure. You know, let's see, you know, what different approaches I can use. You know, trying to, totally approaching my, the guitar, for instance, from a totally different point of view. You know, no longer, you know, something that has six strings on it that you play, you know, upright and get melodies out of. You know, it could be simply a microphone, you know. You know, you could lay it different ways, you know, lay it flat, and, you know, a lot of prepared music was one of the things that I was introduced to, just, you know, people putting screws in pianos and, you know, playing the insides of pianos and, you know, just altering instruments and Harry Parks with the microtonality and all that sort of thing. So it's like, you know, what things can I do? What can I stick in the strings of my guitar? You know, what can I apply to the strings to get different sounds? And just really, I mean, just really started exploring, you know, all those different sounds and adding different things to my vocabulary. And, you know, suddenly, I guess what was considered pop music seemed extremely boring and limited, you know, at that point. Oddly enough, was post music school, and you know, once I felt like I had been able to kind of add some new, you know, it's kind of that idea of someone who uses a big word. They know the word, but they don't really use it in the right context, so it sounds kind of funny. You know, they don't necessarily understand the meaning of it. I didn't want to go out there and start doing something until I felt comfortable, you know, using it. So I mean, it wasn't until later, and luckily, eventually, I ended up moving to Springfield in '94, and was lucky enough to get involved with the Innovators New Music Series after I'd been doing just a bunch of stuff on my own, just extended the experimental recordings and things like that. Was finally able to kind of make my way into that. Some of the music scene as far as performing and actually having someone else other than myself hear the music that I was making.
Right, I remember the Innovators New Music Series.
Yeah.
That's funny, you, a minute ago you mentioned Harry Parch.
Uh-huh.
And then Christopher Brown from Random Touch mentioned him too.
Oh, did he? That's cool.
Well, with Innovators, that was where, and you know, I was aware that obviously there's the whole thing about jazz and experimentation. Everyone knows that to some
right.
degree, even right. in popular knowledge, even if they've never heard any of it.
Right.
But they know that it exists, and they give it, they say, well, jazz has these experimental roots where the experiment was like we didn't really know what we were going to play, so we were winging it. So we were
right.
experimenting in the moment with every note that we were playing. And as comes up in these interviews, we identify that there may be a number of different ways that something could be an experiment. As
yeah, right.
you're pointing out with it, as the next question deals with sound and music, you're still well within music talking about how it was merely an experiment culturally to leave what the music that was the norm that you grew up with and then branch out as you became more aware of this other stuff, not only that people were doing in the West, but like with long albums, but then what was happening with other cultures and other ways of looking at the staff and all of that
right.
even. And
right.
so that's all still within the realm of music. So it's interesting to me how the experimental part can happen on any level within
right.
this whole framework, you know, and
right.
that's what's great about it. And then so the Innovators was, to me, wasn't just jazz, it's from Frank, trumpeter, you know, that they had put that on, and
sure.
and he introduced me to the Knitting Factory and all these, not just, you know, Coltrane and all that, but I mean these things that really actually I guess you really couldn't call it jazz sometimes,
right? Right.
On the show that this is the podcast spinoff of Esoterica, we played a lot of the Innovator stuff, and in fact I saw it as one of the major resources I had for esoteric music to be played on the show. Was
right,
that
right.
And I loved it that it was like, okay, here's the quote unquote jazz wing of the weird music. You know?
Right. Right.
And I kept trying to think of the one band that, out of New York. It was a Knitting Factory band that played there, but I can't remember the name of it. But it wasn't really, it was more like a small orchestra. It wasn't
uh-huh.
really a jazz band. They
right.
weren't playing jazz. I mean, but it was just, it was almost like film music, but really exciting. And they had played
oh, yeah.
here in town. And he had brought them to town. And it was just amazing to watch. There were like five of us there. We
right.
always joke about that. There was like this amazing stuff going on stage in front of us. But the real hard thing to believe was that there were just five of us standing there watching it. This,
right.
How could this happen? That something
yeah.
so monumental was taking place before five people.
Yeah. Exactly.
The band outnumbered us. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I remember, I mean, some of the shows that we would advertise, I mean, because of course we, you know, I mean, of course we ended up, Rich Gilman Opalski, of course, ended up coming to Springfield from New York, and he actually discovered us because of the Innovators New Music Series. Just looking online, I mean, he knew he was coming to Springfield to take his, you know, position at University of Illinois at Springfield. And, of course, you know, he's, you know, a free jazz drummer, and he was looking to see if there was any possibility of anyone to do music with. And just, you know, searching online and had found articles about the Innovators New Music Series, I guess, through Illinois Times. And ended up contacting Frank as a result of that, and just kind of, you know, heads up of like, hey, I'm moving to Springfield from New York. And I don't know if you've ever heard this story, but it's sort of comical because Frank and I had formed Untoward Quartet prior to, which kind of ended up dissolving just because a lot of the people kind of ended up going off their own directions. Joel Stuyzens, who was our drummer, ended up taking a teaching position at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. And so he left, and we're just kind of like, you know, wow, you know, he was kind of like the known, like, free jazz type drummer back then, which is funny because I don't think he plays drums at all anymore. But I remember distinctly having this conversation with Frank on the phone. I was actually standing, I'd driven up to the Chicago suburbs to go visit my parents, and I remember standing on their driveway as I pulled in. Frank had called, and I remember having this conversation just about how nice it would be to be able to put something together again musically. And I remember distinctly saying, you know, it's almost like a drummer would have to drop out of the sky. You know, it's almost like somebody would have to come from somewhere else and be here because I don't, you know what else we would do. And I think within like a week, Frank had gotten contacted by Rich. You know, he said, hey, I'm coming to town. So it's kind of a really funny foreshadowing. And of course, from the first time that the three of us played together, which was, man, what, like 17 years ago or something now? You know, it was pretty much just this really, you know, musical, you know, symbiotic relationship between the three of us. And, you know, it's so funny because I never thought that I would be able to do, once I quit music school and kind of quit, I guess, popular music proper, I pretty much knew that it would never be a source of income for me, which I never really wanted it to be in the first place. And I also kind of question whether or not I would ever even be able to perform any of it anywhere. It's so funny. I mean, I do more music now, and I've done more music since music school than I ever did during or before. You know, so yeah, I've certainly had, you know, the opportunities, and it really, of course, been super grateful that I haven't had to compromise kind of my own musical journey at all in order to be able to play out. So it's been great.
Well, so then what do you think about if you had to choose which camp your material would belong to more, the world of sound or the world of music?
Well, I think definitely based on the different projects, you could argue for both. I mean, there are some that I think I choose to fit more within just kind of the normal bounds of music. Some of the projects I distinctly do trying to push the boundaries of music, and I would say that would definitely be like In Times Trio and Four Saints. I mean, those are the projects where I'm, and my solo stuff. And that's where I'm trying to push kind of my own personal boundaries as well as just the boundaries of what exists out there as far as music goes. So, I mean, those are purposeful. I mean, it's, you know, probably the most extreme, I would say, probably being like the intergalactic music, which is, yeah, I mean, I tried to imagine, you know, one of the Voyager shuttles picking up radio signals, you know, out in space in, you know, essentially alien radio. And so it wasn't just, you know, I remember how absolutely foreign non-Western music sounded to me originally. And it was trying to put that in the context of, like, okay, what if we heard music from, like, actual other creatures, you know? So I would do these mental experiments of, like, okay, this could be, like, a non-humanoid, you know, entity. You know, it could be a slug, you know? It could be, you know, data. You know, it could be a machine. It could be a robot. It could be, you know, I was just trying to... Yeah, I was researching like exoplanets and kind of their conjectured surfaces and things, and you know, water planets, or you know, just lava planets. And it's like, okay, you know, if creatures existed in these things, what kind of music would they make? And so, I mean, I was trying to do
right, and how do we examine the sound music differential with that too?
Exactly.
Would the music that you don't understand as a human being from planet Earth,
right,
would it be music or would it be sound? And then
right,
that forces us to have to ask, well, what? How do we define those two things anyway? Obviously, I would say, and I did say this before when people brought it up, but to me, it's like Samsara and Nirvana. One exists inside of the other. What, you can't have one without the other, but you can have the other one without the one.
Right, so right.
All music is sound, but the
sure.
world of sound goes out and farther even than music. That goes out to like the sound of, you know, cars starting, and I always say birds, and you know, fall into that category too.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah,
but that's closer to what we call music. And I'm always fascinated with where the line gets so blurred.
It's
you
so blurred.
Can't really say anymore. You can't say
right.
which it is, and that's why everybody always wants to say both. And I think the best answer is probably going to be for most experimenters both, because they are definitely going to be looking at both aspects of it. Because again, with Christopher Brown from Random Touch, his definition was, I interpreted it as being kind of a broad definition, or a more interpretive definition, whereas not just based on, you know, are we using the Italian mathematics that we're using for our scale and everything, or he says, well, it's when you get to that point that it has, it elicits an emotional reaction akin to the thing that makes you listen to it again, you know, like, if you're the artist and you put 80% of your work aside, no one ever hears it because it's no good. And then like 20% is the stuff you want to release, say, then you've got all that whole gambit of material, and it's really kind of strange where, depending on your point of view. Really, your point of view really has a lot to do with it, with how you would define all of that. But that's what
kind of what your intention is.
You're someone. Well, he said it's a function of what someone likes enough, that what speaks to you, then it's music.
Right.
Like the general, the muse, you know.
Right.
General term of it, that is music. If the sound of the car engine really turns you on, then it's music to you. And then now it's interesting, isn't it? Because then it's the sound that's eroticized by the art. Is that sound then automatically music?
Right. Well, in my argument,
is it concrete, you know, as opposed to
sure. Yeah, in my argument that would be in the way that it was initially challenged too, was with, you know, some of the just super super harsh experimental music, which is like, I mean, that's not pleasant, you know. You know, there are certain things that are not intended to be pleasant, and you know, people always make these kind of qualitative statements or you know, judgments actually on them of, you know, whether or not they have value. And you know, I guess the way that I've kind of interpreted it is like, yeah, we all like to feel happy and peaceful all the time, but that's not real life. You know, I mean, super negative emotions, sadness, sorrow, you know, those are unpleasant, but they're still part of life. You know, they're part of what brings the richness to life. And so it's like, you know, bands like Sonic Youth and stuff like that, who started introducing, you know, noise elements into their music. I mean, so, you know, they might have some really beautiful passages, but then they also have some that's, you know, what people consider noise. And, you know, and then you get into really harsh stuff that's like, ooh, that's like, I can't, I mean, I remember, like, I mean, there are times where I've been listening to music in the car, and if I had passengers in the car, it was like, you know, asking me to, like, pull over and stop so they could jump out, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's harsh, and it's unpleasant, but it does a good job of being it, you know, like, I always say, like, stinky cheese does a really good job of being stinky, like, that's what it's supposed to do.
Right.
And so unpleasant stuff, you know, is supposed to be unpleasant, and it should make you unpleasant and feel unpleasant. And that's one of the things I had to really challenge myself, especially with intergalactic music, was, I think this probably speaks to one of the later questions too, but I almost had to go against what I felt like sounded good. Mm-hmm. Because it's like I was constructing it based on not only Western but human ears. So it's like, okay, so if this sounds good to me, is it still, am I still trying to interpret what would sound good to a human? You know, as opposed to what might be pleasant for an alien, you know, just in the same way that you think of, and again, it was every single concept that I could think of as far as like frequency range and durations and volumes and all that kind of stuff of, you know, you think of the soundscape that probably is going on, I'm sure is going on for like cats and dogs. I mean, there's probably all kinds of noises you can hear that you don't, obviously, we know.
Right.
So, yeah, again, just even if it's not, you know, what's not pleasant to us might be really, really meaningful to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that specific recording with you, or maybe another one. But that one was interesting to me because you being one of the people, the experimenters that I do think lives more in the realm of music. I just mean more. It's like spectrum, you know? To me, you have more of a music background, and you're bringing that to the table in full force, I think. Not everybody does, you know. Some people, they're more just the sound. And I don't think one's better than the other or anything like that either. But that's what interests me, is that when you took on that problem with that recording, that you were, like one of my instructors used to call everything artwork is a solution to a problem. And the problem you set up was, you were in a sense trying to break out of that.
It was almost like something
the ultimate experiment of breaking out of all the conventions, and those conventions were the rules of the music, not just the sound, but the music itself. And so you're throwing all that out. So you were probably in your most sound like area than ever because of that, because you were moving intentionally away from those other elements that would be, to me, I think music also could look at it like the order as opposed to the chaos. And the sound is, if it's just sound, it's more akin to chaos. There's no order, there's disorder, like anything is random. And then if there's a lot of order and things are together and show a relationship with each other and they start making little patterns and all that, to me that gets closer to what I would call music. And maybe not. So I don't think there's any right answer to any of this, and I'm still using this show to try to come up with the answers, you know, come up with some answers, some usable answers, you know. But to me, when you're doing that, then you were pushing off all that semblance of order in order to try to see what you could come up with. And the challenge was, you kept probably inevitably trying to impose this order on it again, you know? I mean, you have to do this. You couldn't get it recorded if you didn't impose some order on the situation, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, some of the pieces I had to conceive of is the thing, like, they just happened to tune in at a certain part of it. Like, it could have been a piece that lasted for, you know, 6 months, you know, but they just happened to find this, you know, one time, you know, it was just when it was passing through that part of space, you know, that it happened to pick up that, you know, that radio signal or whatever.
Yeah, well, that's what I love about it, too, because I don't just hear it for what it is. I'm also hearing, I hear the exercise, you know?
Right.
I hear what you're trying to do, and it makes it more interesting, you know? It makes it better than just the sound. So then you've got sound and music relationship, but then the concept is another part of it's a separate thing still, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and even beyond that, and the one step kind of further than that even, the actual transmission of the music, which is, you know, one of the things I remember us doing in ethnomusicology was, you know, you're talking about notating, you know, performances from people of non-Western musics, and to delineate between what was an intended sound, like what was an intended part to be part of the music and what was something that just happened. You know, these people that were going back and transcribing, you know, these, you know, ethnomusicologists that, you know, made all these field recordings, but then came back and tried to transcribe them. I mean, they were having to make these judgments about, like, what part was actually considered part of the music and what just happened, you know, at the time, and what was intended, you know, is also, like, what were flaws with the recording equipment? You know, was this sound intended or not? So, you know, I even kind of took that concept of, you know, you're driving down the highway in your car and you're listening to radio stations. And of course, as you get further away, you know, it starts getting distorted or you get kind of that ring modulation or something going on. Like, if that's where you picked it up, like, you wouldn't know if that was an intended sound or not. One of the other stories I really like to tell is that I remember one time I was going out for some Mexican food, and I happened to be listening to the Blood Brothers, a new CD that I'd gotten, and I wasn't really familiar with a lot of their work, and hadn't listened to this album yet because I'd just gotten it. And I remember this one part of this song was just like, I was sitting there in the parking lot waiting for the song to go over, because it got so, like, super distorted and really powerful. I'm like, that's amazing. So I turned off the car, went in and got my food and was coming back out. Went to go start the car and my car wouldn't start. Like, the battery was dead. And so, of course, I got a new battery, blah, blah, blah. You know, went back and listened to the album later. And I'm like, man, where's that? Like, I couldn't find the part of that song that I thought was so cool. And what I realized is, like, that my, like, it was distorting because the battery was dying. Like, that was affecting the sound, and like, I had no idea that that's what was going on at the time. You know, so even thinking about those recordings, it's like, okay, so of the things that you even hear, like with the intergalactic music, like you don't know, like, if are you picking up, you know, a broadcast of like a meeting, you know, of like, you know, these alien beings, you know, is this a conversation? Is it like a phone call? You don't know what it is. And I remember reading this one ethnomusicologist he was studying. I can't remember what tribe it was. But they kept having to correct him constantly because he would call their conversation music and he would call their music conversation because their conversation sounded more musical than their music. Huh. And, like, they kept having to tell him, like, no, that's how we talk. Like, this is our conversation. This is us talking, but this over here is our music. And the two were totally reversed.
Wow.
And so it's that same sort of concept of like, I mean, there's no way that you could even conceive of like what role these sounds play, you know, what function they serve. Is it talking? Is it music? You know, is that even music or else is it just the sound that these creatures were making, you know?
Like, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, just again, it was an ongoing exercise, I think, especially for that. And I did that really to just kind of challenge myself, too, of like, okay, I need to, you know, I think I've expanded my bounds of music, but let's see if I can expand it even further, you know? And so right. That's kind of my exercise in pushing myself to do that even more so.
Wait, do we ever fail at these experiments then?
Oh, yeah, well... I mean, again, I guess it depends on what's your
the last question. Yeah, we have to grapple with the definitions once again.
Yeah.
What's a failure? What's a success? And people have approached it different ways. Most people throw out money making right away because if you're experimenting.
You know? Yeah, exactly right. Well, yeah, of course the joke of free jazz is, you know, you play it for free. But yeah, I mean, I would say a failure would simply be when you didn't end up doing what you intended to do, you know, which would be kind of your own internal failure. You know, it might sound fantastic to other people, you know, but to you, it's not what you intended to do. I think that's probably kind of how I would see it.
Well, what about the happy accident, though?
And again, I mean, that's good. I mean, it's kind of funny because there are times when, for instance, like when In Times Trio plays, and it's funny because we question, like, a lot of it just comes back to how we felt about it. You know, like if we felt like we were all in sync and like communicating and, you know, you just kind of, you know, the music rises above this other level. It's like you're having this three-way ongoing conversation. And, you know, you don't even really realize that other people are sitting there listening, and it's amazing, but people might have sounded awful, you know, to them it might have been totally unpleasant, you know, I don't know, but for us it was fantastic. And there could be other times when we felt like, you know, felt really stiff or really felt like we weren't communicating or whatever, people might be like, oh, that was amazing, like that sounded great. So I think it's just kind of based on what's your qualifications of what a success is, you know, and what's good.
sometimes, yeah, we don't feel like great about a performance, but then we'll go back and listen to a recording and be like, man, that was pretty fantastic. Like, we were happy with how that came out. So I don't know. Like, I mean, there were times where I tried, you know, I would try to do experiments, musical experiments with things, and again, found myself falling back into structures, you know, things like that. It's like, you know, oh man, like, you know, I'm trying to bust out of this and keep finding myself resorting back to just kind of my human Western, you know, musical, right, you know, whatever. So, I mean, to me, that would be kind of a failure, is where it's like, yeah, that's not, I didn't challenge myself or push myself far enough to experiment with this.
With the spectrum, and even if you're just your average musician is always trying to maintain a level of what we might call experimental positioning in order to keep learning new things, to break out of habits or what have you. People just always play one key, or, you know, you want to try to like learn different things, different alternate tunings or whatever, different instruments. And then it just kind of branches out from there. Then you have the other end of the spectrum where someone's actually, like you did, sitting down and trying to come up with a piece of artwork that defies categorization on another level, that defies categorization not only of genre, but of what you even, to reassess what you call music and then do something aside from that. For that to be your problem that you're solving, that's a real, that boggles the mind, you know, but it shows how at some point all these things are always happening on some level for everyone. And then for some people, they just magnify these certain things, and other people, they're not magnifying. It's sort of like learning the rules and then breaking them, you know,
this
whole process of pushing and pulling. So to some level, all musicians are experimenters, and at some level, are all experimenters musicians? You know, see, that's where I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to get to an answer with this journey that we're going on with this podcast, to try to figure out, you know, does it work both ways? You know, because there's a lot of stuff, especially lately, that I've been listening to, and that's a funny thing. You've actually touched that area where people are doing just that. They're trying to break all the preconceived conventions. And maybe even they seem like the type of people, artists, that would be offended if you called their stuff music.
Right.
Now, I remember one time Frank said to me, "You think this is jazz?"
Right.
I just thought that was cool as hell, you know. Exactly the phenomenon that it's delusive. Yeah. There isn't even a word for this. But, you know, you get these people, though, that kind of like their stuff to lean experimental more. And I think there's some degree of that is the appreciation for the sound itself. And that's why you played with butter knives and marbles with your guitar, like a microphone, as you say. And just the effects that, I mean, you had some of those, is it Electrofaustus? Fly?
Yeah. Yeah,
Black Fly?
Yeah, Black Fly. Oh, yeah.
And stuff like that, you know, that makes use of, and I've seen people retrofit those, and I've seen other versions of those that people have had, and I thought, yeah, exactly. And it's just really interesting how this all fits together for us. I mean, I thought of a couple other things, but I don't want to go on too long.
I'd
love to have you back to talk about a specific recording. Like I said, I don't know if you want it to be this one that we've just been talking about, but I mean, whatever you choose.
I mean, which, yeah, whatever is fine. One of the things I was going to mention real quick is that I distinctly remember at some point where it sounds weird, but I could physically tell that I was listening to music using a different side of my brain. It is very strange because it was very distinct though. Because it's weird because I really only recently kind of have learned about the kind of the different sides. Like, essentially we interpret language in music with words with the left side of the brain. Right-handedness is sort of doing language and math and kind of further context, whereas, you know, left-handedness, right brain is much more about numbers and just colors and artistic and higher concepts and things like that. And, you know, one of the things that I was introduced to, of course, through ethnomusicology was just kind of the whole Eastern approach to music, which is, they interpret everything as music. Everything kind of falls within the category of sound, which they categorize as music. So, if you're listening to a piece of music and a train goes by, it's not that the train is interrupting the music. It's also kind of the same concept of just accepting things kind of in the present moment as the way that they are. You know, the train is part of the music. It's not, you know, noise to it. You know, and interpreting, you know, I mean, if it's raining outside and it's like the dripping water, you know, that becomes part of the music. And first recording I ever got from Fred Fripp was Step Across the Border, which of course is a soundtrack to a film about him and just music and things like that. And it's so interesting because you can listen to the CD and basically feel like you've watched the movie, and you can watch the movie and feel like you've heard the soundtrack, of course, because he uses the sounds of the environment and the music and writes compositions around those. So, I mean, the candy-making machine is just another instrument that's part of the music, or, the person working in the Japanese rock garden, just different things. You know, he's out having a conversation with seagulls playing his violin, and you can't tell which one is his violin and which one's a seagull, you know, or writing compositions around cars, you know, Washington Bridge, you know, New York or whatever. And it's totally breaking down that line between what's sound and what's noise and what's music. And I physically felt that shift of going from listening to music with solely the left side of my brain to, the right side. Which is very strange. And since then, again, it's been a totally different experience as far as just, everything is a possible sound. It could be used,
Right.
Working in the oil factory, listening to the intervals of the machines running, things like that, so.
Well, what do you think? What would you like to say? What your list of projects? Because you really even said, and how could people find your music?
Sure. Well, Forest Saints is kind of a psych prog project. Pretty much my project is just pretty much open-ended as far as anything goes. So, like the intergalactic music that we were talking about, I've released it under that name. I've done, I guess you'd call it music for meditation, but for me it's more just music to help me focus. Circling above. as well as just, you know, finished compositions, kind of experimental electronic and type of things. Pretty much no rules go for that. So Four Saints, and that's available through Bandcamp as well as now I'm forgetting the name of it. Spotify and Amazon and things like that. So that End Times Trio, jazz trio, we actually just had one recording out called Fractured Time, which is available through CD Baby. My solo stuff, which would be kind of solo experimental guitar stuff as well as computer compositions, is available through Bandcamp, just under my name. And then the lesser, I would say, probably non-experimental things would be Thin Ghost, which of course is just kind of my throwback to just kind of the old comfy jeans or comfy pair of shoes or whatever. It's kind of my way of viewing the music, just kind of my folksy roots. So it's acoustic-based music. I'm really not trying to make any strides musically that way as far as experimentation goes.
Right.
And then Demons on Wheels, which is kind of my startup, is essentially kind of garagey rock. It's probably evolved a little bit more into kind of indie and hard rock, but I mean, it's still a rock project. There's some experimentation in there with noise. I kind of loosened up my own personal rules for it a little bit to introduce at least some noise, kind of more Sonic UV type noise stuff in there. But Demons on Wheels. And those are
more aggressive.
Yeah. Demons on Wheels was, you know, songs I recorded for Four Saints, and I'm like, I want to do more of that, and maybe just a whole album of that is kind of how Demons on Wheels had started. And then Thin Ghost was actually a working band that I had in the past prior to Four Saints, but of course, you know, there are songs that showed up on some early Four Saints albums, and I'm just like, that sounds so much like Thin Ghost. You know, I want to do some of that again, and just started doing that. So those are both available through Bandcamp and Amazon and Spotify and things like that as well. I have a couple other I'm always usually working on about three or four albums too, and I have some other stuff that's in the works now. I have probably, probably 80 old songs of Thin Ghost songs that I've been trying to release periodically, and I'm going to continue to try to work on some of those and release some of those. Almost done with the next Thin Ghost album. And then I have actually a kind of a throwback 80s new wave album that I'm working on. I've actually been working on that for a little while. And I've actually started working on some other stuff that's kind of trying to do myself in other directions that I don't normally go in. So there's even some kind of heavier than Demons on Wheels stuff that I'm starting to work on, as well as some pretty heavy electronic type stuff as well.
Awesome.
That I started working on. So, yeah, just kind of trying to traveled down a bunch of different avenues and areas and at least visit there and see what I think about it.
Yeah. Well, keep it up.
And yeah. Thank you.
I hope to hear some of it, and we'll play it on the show, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've been starting to collaborate a little bit, trying to branch out. I was trying to get some additional singers for the 80s stuff. 80s singing styles are so strange. And some of the other things, just trying to maybe bring some other people into the projects too. So of course, with the pandemic, it's made that a little difficult. But
yeah.
So, certainly appreciate the interest in the opportunity to chat about music.
Oh, yeah. No problem. It's my pleasure. Thanks for coming on. And hang on. I'll talk to you after.
Okay. Sounds good.
So, hey, I really appreciate you coming on, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you.